This is Audible.
Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fear Less, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction, by Dean Slyter. Narrated by Dean Slyter. The capacity for experience is what burns out fear. James Baldwin. The Cowardly Lion.
Somebody pulled my tail.
The Scarecrow. Oh, you did it yourself. The Wizard of Oz. Part 1. Come and See. Chapter 1. The Monster Under the Bed. I was scared of the ball. They called it a softball, but it seemed plenty hard to me. I had felt it sting my fingers, smack my chest. As it shot toward me, my whole body flinched, that is, when it came toward me at all, as I stood exiled in far right field, where the team hoped I would do the least damage. I was the skinny, uncoordinated kid, the spaz in the fifth-grade playground lingo of the day. The only game I was good at was dodgeball. Not hurling the ball at others, but jumping out of its way. That made perfect sense to me. Every recess started with the mortifying ritual of choosing teams. The two captains, Big Chuck and Quick Wiry Ricky, picked boys from best to worst till they finally came to the slow, heavy kid and me, the dreaded dregs. After much disgusted stalling, one captain would sigh dramatically and say, "Okay, we'll take fats if you take spaz." In the classroom, I had no fear. I cheerfully took over discussions, settling back in my seat and enjoying a chummy tete-a-tete with the teacher, only dimly aware of the restless fidgeting going on all around me. Eventually, I noticed Chuck in the back corner near the door, self-exiled to his own right field, head down, trying for once to be small. A history question shooting toward him threatened as much danger and humiliation as a softball did for me. Different people, different situations, same feeling. Interesting. The Cold War was on. In social studies, we watched black and white propaganda films about communism, with grim narrators and the crab-like hammer and sickle squatting over the map of Europe, sprouting evil tentacles of world domination. From time to time, in the middle of a math or geography lesson, the teacher would suddenly shout, "Drop!" We'd fall to our knees and duck and cover under our desks, waiting for a commie A-bomb to come hurtling toward Woodlake Avenue Elementary School, wondering just how effectively our wooden desktops would shield us from the thermonuclear fireball. Now we're grown-ups. Terrorists have replaced communists, and we've graduated from the playground to other grounds for fear. The office, the boardroom, the bedroom, the barroom, and the newsroom. The last presidential election was fueled by fear, and it's been a white-knuckle ride ever since, with spiking anxiety levels reported by psychologists nationwide. The political is personal. But no matter who's elected today or impeached tomorrow, our deepest fears persist. Fear of pain, fear of confusion, fear of change, fear that things will never change, that this is all there is. Fear of responsibility, fear of aging and illness, fear of loss, bereavement, abandonment. Fear that the good times are over, that joy has fled. Fear of boredom, loneliness, intimacy, violation. Fear of failure, rejection, humiliation. Fear of others' opinions, of our own feelings, of being fooled, of blowing it on stage, of being exposed as a bewildered child among the confident adults. Fear for the planet. We look to the world our children will inherit and wonder if it will be the Jetsons or Mad Max. Fear of missing out. For years I was haunted by my high school English teacher's story of his father, who traveled the world, saw the sights, had more adventures than the next 10 men, but died screaming, screaming, because he felt that, whatever life was all about, he had missed it. Our fears may be rooted in big traumas haunting the past or big challenges looming in the future, but they cast their shadow over the smallest moments of everyday life right now. We're afraid of wearing the wrong outfit to the party, of sounding stupid if we speak up in the meeting, of getting lost if we take the scenic route. Choices must be made, and we long for the time when we chose out of joy, should I play on the slide or the jungle gym, rather than fear. Will it be worse if I tell my partner how I feel or keep it to myself? When we're not sure what to be afraid of, which threat to dodge next and what direction it will come from, our fear mutates into free-floating anxiety. To soothe our anxiety, we might fall into addiction, taking refuge in a drug or drink, or in compulsive eating or gambling or gaming or hoarding or sex, or in cutting or starving ourselves, or in magical belief systems or bogus political messiahs, anything that offers to give me shelter when I feel like I'm gonna fade away. But that sets off new fears that we'll run out of the drugs or Oreos, or the girlfriend or boyfriend will run out on us, or the belief system will break down when we need it most. Then we lash out in anger at whoever or whatever allegedly threatens our alleged security. These and the other afflictive emotions, grief, loneliness, guilt, jealousy, confusion, shame, disappointment, resentment, greed, self-righteousness, exasperation, despair, are all deeply connected. Whether they're boiling over into crisis or simmering toxically on a back burner, they're all brewed from fear. They all make us feel unfree and alone. Whether I'm playing my 11th game of Candy Crush and trying to forget I have a term paper to write, or I'm off in a corner with my spoon and my quart of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, I feel like I'm all alone and no one must know, even when everyone knows. Of course, this isn't the whole picture. If you're lucky and you're paying attention, life offers any number of joys and wonders. Many of us manage to sidestep the most destructive habits and scenarios and to lead reasonably sane, progressive lives. But even in your happiest moments, playing with your healthy, laughing kids, even in your most sublime moments, lost in the music, even in your most thrilling moments, merging in ecstasy with the lover you were born for, even then, hovering in some dim corner that we try our best to ignore, is the final, definitive fear, your eventual annihilation, and that of everything and everyone you love. All this must end. Nevermore, game over, bye-bye, here's your hat, no refunds, no apologies, no exceptions. Death is in the house and demands to be fed. He'll eat you and your little dog, too. And yet, perhaps you've known people for whom this is all somehow different, who seem to have some deep wisdom, some internal gyroscope that keeps them balanced, some inner silence that inoculates them against the standard craziness and panic. Maybe it was an uncle or aunt, a wise teacher or professor, the nice lady at the corner store, the plumber. Maybe your most inspiring exemplars were movie characters, Yoda or Obi-Wan Kenobi, Aslan, Gandalf, Mary Poppins, Glinda the Good Witch. But you're at least vaguely aware that there are supposed to have been real people who have embodied that silent wisdom fully. Enlightened people, awakened ones, sages. There are. Even if we don't know exactly what sages might look like, we're pretty sure they're not racked with anxiety. They're not caught up in anger. And they're not overwhelmed with fear, even fear of death. Whether it's Jesus on the cross, Al-Hallaj on the gallows, Socrates drinking the hemlock, or the Buddha calmly calling for his students' final questions while dying of excruciating septic shock. No matter what they undergo, their every breath is breathed from a place of bottomless silence. Just close your eyes for a moment, think of any one of them, and you can practically taste it. That might seem to put them on some lofty spiritual peak, inaccessible to us ordinary schmoes. But they've all declared that, as they are, we can and will be, and that the unshakable silence, whether they call it nirvana, or moksha, or fana, or the kingdom of heaven, is within us. Not might be within us someday, but is within us now. If we reflect back on our lives, the joys, the challenges, the lonely moments out in our own personal right field, we might even sense that, somewhere in the background, that silence has been with us, within us, all along. Our project together will simply be to bring it from the background to the foreground. Fortunately, that's the most natural thing in the world. All our lives we've been looking for the right thing, but in the wrong places, looking outside for what's inside. It's just a matter of settling back into yourself, into the infinite okayness that is your own deepest nature. All those words like fear, loneliness, craving, anger, anxiety, anguish, grief, are finally just different names for deprivation of that okayness. Certainly our fears can seem devastating. We can't just sprinkle a little spiritual pixie dust and shrug them off. But in the light of the deeper truth to which we'll now be opening, our fear is just fear. Unbelievable as it may sound, things are ultimately fine. The awakened ones agree. The sages are here, the grown-ups, come to shine their brilliant light under the bed and show us there's no monster. Waking up. This experience of silence and okayness is not something distant or exotic. It's completely intimate to you. In fact, you've probably had glimpses of it. Some people call it the zone and encounter it at moments of peak athletic performance. But it can just as well sneak up on you while you're weeding the garden or washing the dishes, running your sales meeting or playing your ukulele. It comes unbidden. Suddenly, you no longer feel stuck in your body. You're watching everything, witnessing it from some unspecified, unconfined space, while your actions roll on with a wonderful, effortless grace, as if no one is doing them, yet they're done impeccably. Somehow time falls away. Colors might seem brighter, sounds sharper, the air sweeter, as if a veil has fallen from your senses. Everything is deliciously weightless, frictionless, silent, even amid commotion and noise. And, although we're not apathetic or numb but vividly awake, there's a deep sense, which has no explanation and needs none, that everything is just fine. At these moments, you probably don't stop to ponder your problems. Why would you do that? But if you did, none of them, up to and including death, would appear problematic. It's as if they, like you, are made of pure, open space. And then, as quietly as it came, the glimpse ends, usually to be forgotten or dismissed as some passing oddity. But it's not an oddity. That's the promise of the sages. They say it's natural and real to live and breathe from that silence full time. Then, among other fortunate side effects, our fear, anger, anxiety, and addictions start to thin out and eventually evaporate. We realize that this friction-free, problem-free lightness isn't just some pleasant dream or fleeting high. Against all odds, the heaviness turns out to be the dream. The monster turns out to be the dream. As the great 20th century Indian sage Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj said, "Learn to look without imagination, to listen without distortion. That is all. You will experience peace and freedom from fear." Accessing that space of freedom is easier than people think. You don't have to change your job or your wardrobe, your philosophy or your diet. Those matters are all far more superficial than what we're addressing. No one owns the zone, so it's not inherently Eastern or Western, Buddhist or Christian, or even spiritual, whatever that means. There's nothing to believe, including anything you hear in this book. My favorite saying of the Buddha is, "Ehi Pasiko," come and see. Not come and believe, or come and hope, or speculate, or argue. It's pure scientific method. Try something, see what you experience, and if it seems beneficial, you'll probably want to do more of it, till you don't have to do it anymore. The sages who have come and seen didn't live only in ancient times. I've had the good fortune to hang out with more than one. Some have been lamas or rishis in robes. Some have been ordinary-looking folks in casual wear. I've spent most of my life following their guidance, confirming it in my own experience, and, with their encouragement, sharing it with others. What they've taught me, and what I'll be sharing here, consists of practice and view. Practice is method, technique, stuff you do. And our core practice, the one that has revolutionized my life, is natural meditation. Just like on the product labels in the supermarket, natural means without artificial ingredients. If we tried to do the things that most people associate with meditation, sit in a strained, uncomfortable posture, or try to push out thoughts, or force our attention to stay concentrated on some object, or concoct some kind of happy face mood when we really feel like slugging someone, that would be artificial. If you try to meditate, it's, well, trying. But as we've already seen, the zone of great freedom sneaks up on us, like a thief in the night, as St. Paul says. So the most natural and effective kind of meditation is not so much doing as being. It's not going afield in pursuit of some far-out experience, but staying right where we are, with the doors and windows of our consciousness wide open, so the thief can make himself at home. As you'll see, it's just a matter of sitting quietly, not pushing stuff out, but allowing the silence to pull you in. It's good to sit every day, but because this way of non-effort is so effective, you don't have to devote long hours to it. Our syllabus. Before we dive into this core practice, here in part one, we'll warm things up with a few preliminary practices and strategies. Some don't require any sitting at all. You can put them to use right away, applying them in situations where anger, fear, worry, or addictive cravings may arise. They'll help to gently reorient the way you experience life, so that you're less caught up, more grounded and relaxed, in a more friendly relationship with yourself and your world. In part two, you'll learn to sit in natural meditation. Because it's so simple, there's not a lot to learn, but to preserve that simplicity, we'll explore the method thoroughly and eliminate the possible ways of making it complicated. We'll walk through a few sessions together and then cover the details of integrating meditation into ordinary life, establishing a regular practice that will keep you, over the weeks and months, opening into the silence with growing clarity and depth. In part three, we'll introduce several supporting practices, side dishes to go with the main course, and you'll get a sense of which ones you connect with most strongly. Some are eyes-closed meditative techniques with specialized functions, such as breaking out of the sense of isolation that fear can produce, or flushing out the old emotional debris of shame or guilt. Some practices use ordinary activities such as breathing or walking, repurposed to undercut our afflictive emotions. Some can be inconspicuously applied right at the moment when you're trying to muster the courage to board the plane or ask that nice girl or guy for a date, or when you're angry at the rush hour traffic, or when the buzz of anxiety is keeping you from falling asleep. None are difficult, and some are actually a lot of fun. The idea is to make life easier, not harder. In addition to practice, the other component of awakening, which we'll explore in part 4, is view. View is not mere opinion or idea. As the word implies, it's seeing. Seeing clearly so that we perceive the reality that's right in front of us but was previously obscured by our confused ideas. Suppose one day you notice your neighbor peering at your house with a pair of high-powered binoculars. Is he a spy? A peeping Tom? Soon all his actions, walking his dog, watering his lawn, become suspect, and your sunny street becomes a dark alley of conspiratorial doom. But then he drops by with binoculars in hand and tells you there's a rare golden-cheeked warbler nesting in your tree. Would you like to take a look? In one moment, your old confusion drops away, and with it your fear and anxiety. Without changing anything, everything is fine. It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. I've shared practice and view with scientists and musicians, filmmakers and lawyers, software engineers and martial artists, addicts and therapists, grad students, prisoners, doctors, and a couple of comedians. I've taught CEOs in the Guatemalan rainforest and car salesmen in New Jersey. Again and again, I've seen that it works. Different people, different situations, same report. The clouds part, the sky clears, the fear and anger and the rest of it start to drain away. Anyone can do it. You may feel sure that you're the one exception, and that's fine. You don't have to believe in it. Just try it. Come and see. There's a track on the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street that I love, a throbbing, pulsing gospel blues jam in which Mick Jagger sings, preacher-style, about yearning for an experience of Jesus that goes beyond mere belief. It's titled, I Just Want to See His Face. Does this mean you'll become a fully awakened, utterly fearless sage overnight? Probably not, but that's okay too. A certain amount of fear, after all, is part of a perfectly healthy alarm system. Nature gives us just enough fear of snakes to make sure we avoid the venomous ones. But if, like one friend of mine, you can't walk into a pet shop because you're afraid the snakes will smash their glass tanks, jump through the air, and attack you, then your alarm system has been cranked up to 11 and needs to be recalibrated. We can do that. We have the technology. And then any remaining traces of fear just become part of the bigger okayness. I'm still not wild about dealing with softballs, or for that matter, any other kind of sporting equipment. Fine. I once heard the Dalai Lama confess that he's afraid of worms. He gets a good laugh out of it. The Bhagavad Gita, India's classic text of meditation and action, says, even a little of this practice delivers from great fear. If, after a little practice, you fear less, even 1% less than before, then you're already coming out of the darkness and into the light. You've made it through the worst. And more light awaits you. You just have to turn toward it. As the poet Hafez wrote, ever since happiness heard your name, it has been running through the streets, trying to find you. Chapter 2. Breathe Through Your Feet. Let's get to it, then. You're in a conference with your soon-to-be ex and a couple of divorce lawyers, or you're waiting for the doctor to call with the results of your biopsy, or you're sweating through your third week of sobriety and trying hard to hang on. Or you're on your umpty-umpth morning commute and feeling your road rage approach the boiling point. Or you're in the dentist's chair, bracing yourself for the root canal. Those are some serious situations. We're going to start our path of awakening by addressing them with what may seem like a completely unserious technique. In fact, it may seem almost insultingly unresponsive to the gravity of the situation. But appearances can be deceiving. In the immortal words of Spinal Tap, it's such a fine line between stupid and, clever. Come and see. Breathe through your feet. That's it, essentially. Simple, but let's break it down. You can be sitting, standing, or lying down with your eyes closed or open, although it's probably best to practice this first with eyes closed. Bring your attention to the soles of your feet. You might notice that this completely ordinary act of attention takes no effort. As soon as you think of it, it's already happening. You might also notice that it involves a sort of combination of feeling and subtle visual imagining, which you've done all your life. If I say left ear, you immediately imagine feel your left ear, with no effort or learning curve required. Now, breathe normally, as you already are, but each time you breathe in, imagine feel that you're breathing in through the soles of your feet. Each time you breathe out, imagine feel that you're breathing out through the soles of your feet. That's all. Don't worry about how fast or slow or deep or shallow your breathing is, or whether your breathing pattern stays the same or changes. Don't strain to concentrate or focus. Don't try to push away thoughts or sounds or anything else. Don't try to feel any special way. Just breathe through your feet and let everything else be however it is. Please take a few moments to do this right now. Okay, welcome back. You may notice now that you feel a little less stuck in your head, in the buzzing of thoughts and feelings. Perhaps there's some sense of being more grounded, centered, or refreshed. If you're not sure, that's fine too. Meditative experience, which is what this is constantly changing. And we don't worry about whether it seems subjectively good or bad in any given session. Now, as you go through your day, you can come back from time to time to this practice of breathing through your feet. Be creative about invoking it in different places and situations. This is your new toy. Anytime you like, you can pull it out of your pocket and play with it. When you're stopped at a red light, standing in line, waiting for your movie to start, working at your computer. Tune in to the technique and get familiar with it when things are fairly relaxed and uneventful. Then, when the stress hits the fan, you're ready. Even as your plane hits the turbulence, or you're driving through the scary part of town late at night, or you're nervously waiting for the audition or job interview, or you're getting the phone call from the bad news boyfriend, you can breathe through your feet and you fear less. You've practiced the drill and you're ready for the fire. Feelings of anger or worry or craving for your drug of choice will still arise. Don't try to suppress those feelings, but don't act them out either. Don't fixate on them or try to distract yourself from them. The feelings are just there, like everything else. The temperature of the air, the color of the walls or the sky. You have to breathe anyway, so just breathe through your feet, and you may notice that you're not quite as tightly gripped by the stressful feelings as you were before. When you go to bed tonight, you may particularly enjoy falling asleep while breathing through your feet. If you normally toss and turn, you may find that this makes sleep a smoother cruise, and if you wake up in the night, you can just cruise some more. See what happens. Chapter 3. Relax at the moment of contact. The experience is all too familiar. You know you can no longer put off that onerous phone call to that difficult person. Right outside your window, it's a perfect spring day, but all you can feel is dread, like a vice tightening around your temples. In the previous chapter, we referred to this as being gripped by the stressful feelings. But if we look more carefully, is that really what happens? Do the feelings grip us, or in some way are we gripping them? No matter what we feel gripped by, whether it's tension, apprehension, obsession, anything, the question is the same, and the answer is important. If it turns out that it's us that's been gripping all along, that's excellent news. That means we can stop. But how would we do that? It seems obvious that the opposite of gripping is letting go, and let go is advice you'll often hear. In fact, it's become a bit of a cliche in the worlds of therapy and meditation. But it's often construed in a way that backfires. People hear the word go and think that the thing they're letting go of is supposed to go away, and then they feel frustrated when it doesn't. They'll often say, "I'm trying to let go, but I can't." But that's not letting go. That's insisting that the thought or feeling disappear, which is a backdoor way of holding on to it. So forget about letting go. Instead, just relax your grip. Then it doesn't matter whether the thought or feeling continues to hang around or not. We can't control that, and we don't have to. To be clear about this, let's do an experiment. If you happen to have a ball handy, such as a tennis ball or beach ball, please place it on your open palm and grip it tightly from beneath. Walk around the room like this, from the chair to the table to the window or whatever landmarks are there. This is your mind gripping some thought or feeling. It encounters all the aspects of day-to-day living, all the room's landmarks, but its experiences of them are filtered through the tension of that gripping. Now relax your grip on the ball and walk around some more. The ball may fall away immediately or eventually, or it may remain in your hand, but it doesn't matter. The hand is open and at ease. The landmarks are experienced with clarity, just as they are, without the distorting filter of tension. Our new practice is simply to take this habit on the road, to apply it in real-life situations. It does require some attention at first to recognize when you're tightening up. Although it may be subtle, there's generally a physical component to that tightening, a sort of bracing of the body. You may feel it in a particular region. For many people, it's the neck, lower back, or gut, but it can be anywhere. Notice it, relax your grip, and just sink back into yourself. Initially, there may be moments when the newness of this approach makes it a little disconcerting. Over the years of using your old approach, you may have come to equate being tense with being conscientious. You may wonder, can I really take care of business effectively without my old tightness? Or am I just being flaky and irresponsible? But once you try the new way a few times, experience will show you that when you're loose, you're actually more effective. Tightness restricts your range of motion and narrows your vision, keeping you from seeing possible solutions to problems. If you're all wrapped up in fuming at the slow-moving traffic, you may not notice the clear side streets that can get you around it. If you're caught up in anxiety about the impression you're making in your job interview, you may not see the warm smile or hear the gracious comments that the interviewer is making to signal that you're doing fine. Loose doesn't mean sloppy or undisciplined. It means open enough to be sensitive and responsive, to act in the moment when you have to move faster than you can think. You can see this in great athletes, martial artists, dancers, actors, as well as teachers, parents, and entrepreneurs. There's no way to do what they do if you're tightly coiled. Cary Grant, who exuded supremely cool sophistication on the screen, recognized the importance of coolness in his co-stars. "I've worked with Bergman, I've worked with Hepburn, I've worked with some of the biggest stars, but Grace Kelly was the best actress I've ever worked with in my life. That woman was total relaxation, absolute ease. She was totally there. Years ago, when I was studying the martial art of Aikido with my teacher Rick Stickles, I had an experience that brought this point home to me in a very dramatic, physical way. I was practicing for a test where I would have to repel three opponents as they repeatedly rushed me. Aikido, when it's done right, is beautiful to watch, almost dance-like. Rather than clash with your attackers, you use their own energy and, in big, circular, pivoting movements, send them rolling or sailing across the mat. But as the first attacker rushed in to grab me and I tried to execute the throw, I couldn't budge him. We wound up grappling instead, locked in place, as the other two rushed in to take me down. This happened again and again, till suddenly I heard the teacher's voice. Halfway up the stairs to the dressing room, he had paused to watch, and he called out, "Relax at the moment of contact." Was I tensing up? That was news to me. I had been too busy tensing up to realize I was tensing up. But now, as the next attacker grabbed me, I relaxed. No longer frozen in my own rigidity, no longer working against my own tension, I felt my shoulders go soft and my energy drop from my upper body to my hips. In the same moment, I pivoted gracefully and threw the attacker with fluid ease. Wow, that was fun. But then, as the next attacker came in, I tensed up again. Once more, Stickles-sensei called out, "Relax at the moment of contact," and once again I softened, pivoted, and easily made the throw. And again. And again. Every time I popped out of that zone of relaxation, the throw became difficult or impossible. Every time I sank back into it, it was easy. It was like turning a switch on and off. The difference was so stark, it was funny. Anything you can do better from that place of fluidity and ease. Anything. There's never a reason not to relax. Until it becomes habitual, you do have to think about it and make a deliberate choice. First, the challenge comes at you, like one of my three attackers. Maybe it's, "Uh-oh, here comes my crazy neighbor again to complain about my trash cans." Or, "Uh-oh, here I go again, walking to the front of the conference room to give my presentation and embarrass myself." Or, "Uh-oh, here I am on a first date again, and I really like this person. Do I seem too eager or too apathetic? Am I laughing too loud?" The circumstances are different, but the "uh-oh" is the same. And that's what you have to notice. That's where the physical clenching takes place. Notice how that clenching feels in the body, and then unclench. No one has to teach you how to unclench. You just did it with the ball. You just have to remember to unclench. This is a subtle skill, and it does take time to integrate it into our way of being in the world. It's a matter of replacing an old, turbulent habit with a new, chill one. The change is not merely attitudinal, but neurological. We're retraining our nervous system to process experiences in a more cooled-out way, so that it doesn't interpret every moment of contact as an occasion for fight or flight. These moments of contact are not always so obvious or dramatic. I once spent a winter in southeast Iowa on a college campus where the freezing subarctic winds whipped through my skinny bones. One day, as I walked across the quad with a friend, wretchedly hunching my shoulders and tensing my muscles as usual, he pointed out that it didn't help. "Try dropping your shoulders and relaxing instead," he suggested. I tried it, and damned if I didn't feel a little bit warmer and a lot more relaxed. That's how you do it. For that winter wind, just substitute the homework you've been putting off, the new job you've been afraid to start, the breakup speech you've been avoiding, the irate driver in the next car, whatever's attacking you, and relax at the moment of contact. I would like a time machine, please, and just half a minute to visit my 9-year-old self, the wretched spaz standing desolate out in right field, terrified of the ball hurtling toward him, and fated over the next dozen years to have puberty, high school, drugs, college, sex, first loves, and first heartbreaks all hurtle toward him as well. Also, some pretty scary encounters with street thugs, cops, and the draft board. I would tell him, "Psst, Dean, listen up. Relax at the moment of contact. Don't forget." There's a further implication here, which would be too much to explain to young Dean in 30 seconds, but which we're now beginning to explore. To relax rather than tighten is to drop our ineffective, imaginary armor and let things be as they are. That's the beginning of a more intimate, accepting relationship with the world, a kind of embrace. There's a beautiful prayer that says, "May all my actions be motivated by love rather than fear." Eventually, this embrace becomes love. And love, as you may have heard, and you'll soon see for yourself, casts out fear. Chapter 4. The Sweetest Dog in the World. When your fear kicks in, or your grief, or craving, or anxiety, or rage, or whatever you've got, there are two basic ways to mishandle it. You've probably tried both. One way is to suppress it. As the word implies, that's a matter of pressing it down. Unfortunately, when you pretend it doesn't exist, it doesn't go away. You've just temporarily pressed it somewhere out of sight, like sweeping dust under a rug. Often it gets pressed down into the body, where it may manifest as back pain, stomach problems, hypertension, or other stress-related ailments. The other way, essentially the opposite of the first, is to indulge the feeling. Having perhaps tried to suppress the fear or anger or anxiety and failed, we swing in the other direction and let it take over. We sit smack in the middle of it as it becomes our whole reality, both the feeling and the story around it. This thing happened, and then that thing happened, and what if this other thing happens, and oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no. Clearly, we need a more skillful way to navigate, one that steers between these two big rocks into the clear waters beyond. Who can help us out here? Cue the dog. Please imagine that the sweetest, most loving, most faithful, most empathetic dog in the world is sitting with you right now. You may be so fortunate as to have the sweetest dog in the world, in which case you don't have to imagine. If you're a cat person, well, despite the stereotype of aloof disdain, I've met some deeply empathetic cats, but not many. Your call. So, here you sit with the sweetest, let's say, dog in the world. Wow, look at those beautiful eyes. The softest, clearest, most loving eyes imaginable. You can see that he, let's say, is all heart. Go ahead, then, and tell him your story. Hard things happen in this life, and this is your chance to declare them. Pour out your feelings. Go all the way with it. Totally spill your guts. All-out indulgence, the indulgier the better. The dog never cuts you off, never questions, never judges, and never loses interest. He pays rapt, loving attention. Keep pouring out your story and all the feelings connected with it till there's nothing left to pour. Then take a little breather, maybe walk around the block. And now, sit down and go through the story again, but with one big difference. This time, first close your eyes and imagine that you're the dog. Feel what it feels like to be under all that doggy fur, inside that doggy metabolism, picking up the subtle aromas of your environment with your sharp doggy nose, looking around the room with your sweet doggy eyes. And then, oh, Here's your dear human friend, the one you love so much. And now your friend is making those funny sounds with the mouth again. They're not sit or stay, so they're completely incomprehensible. But that doesn't keep you from listening with unfailing attention and total, unquestioning love. In fact, that makes you the perfect listener. You don't judge or disagree or agree. You don't interpret or try to interject your own stories. You're just wide open to all that waka 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 and to the feelings that it conveys. You can understand feelings, big-hearted pooch that you are. So much upsetness. But it doesn't stick anywhere inside you. It all goes straight to your heart, where it instantly dissolves into perfect, loving, open space. In this way, just keep listening to the whole story, happily absorbing all those meaningless words, each of them gone and forgotten the moment you hear them, and keep lovingly receiving the feelings as they instantly dissolve in your doggy heart, till it's all been once again told and poured out. And looking out through your eyes of doggy love, really see your human friend, so vulnerable, so sincere, just trying to get through life, just wanting to relax and be okay. Fortunately, you're an expert. You can show your friend how it's done by doing nothing in particular but being as you are. Good dog. Chapter 5. Would it help? In Steven Spielberg's 2015 Cold War thriller, Bridge of Spies, Mark Rylance plays the captured Soviet mole Rudolf Abel. He has a soft-spoken, deadpan quality, with just a hint of a sardonic smile occasionally crossing his face. In their first jailhouse meeting, Tom Hanks, as James Donovan, the American lawyer assigned to defend Abel, warns him not to speak to anyone else. Donovan: I have a mandate to serve you. Nobody else does. Quite frankly, everybody else has an interest in sending you to the electric chair. Abel: All right. Donovan: You don't seem alarmed. Abel considers for a moment, then shrugs almost imperceptibly. Would it help? This is the film's most memorable line. People who spot Rylance on the street now call it out to him. For me, it carries an echo of a Yiddish expression I heard a lot growing up. Gur nisht helfen, meaning nothing will help. Always uttered in a tone of head-shaking, wouldn't-you-know-it exasperation. Just as we thought, life is stacked fatally against us. But Abel's question, would it help, is not fatalistic. It's a simple, clear-eyed nod to reality. You may win, you may lose, and worrying won't make any difference, so why subject yourself to it? Why indulge in it? Rylance won an Oscar for his understated performance. Audiences recognize the almost palpable stillness that is the root of sanity and dignity in the face of danger. This is how real grown-ups, who know that worry is an extravagance, carry themselves. The line also recalls the wisdom of the 8th-century Buddhist sage Shantideva. If there's a solution, what's the point of worrying? If there's no solution, what's the point of worrying? Can you feel the liberative power of this insight? Right now you can acknowledge that absolutely, definitely, positively, in this moment and for the rest of your life, no amount of lost sleep will ever keep your stocks from crashing, or keep your kids safe from the influence of knucklehead friends, or give you a better Gleason score on your prostate biopsy, or make the politicians in Washington obey the instructions you shout at them through the TV screen, or, for that matter, make your old girlfriend or boyfriend come back and beg your forgiveness. Some people call this resignation. Fine. The root of that word is resign. Worrying is a lot of work, and no one's paid me yet, so I resign. Take this job and shove it. And you really can resign. Many people have, and not just Russian spies. One apparently was Alfred Hitchcock. On the set of Notorious one day, he was in conference with his cinematographer when a small fire broke out. Hitchcock, never missing a beat, finished his sentence, turned to some stagehands and said dryly, "Will someone please put that fire out?" Then he went on with his conversation. Another non-worrier is Willie Nelson, who, in a recent interview, sounds like a country version of Shantideva. "I've never seen worrying about anything change it, so I decided not to do it. You know we're all gonna die, so we all have to say, okay, I may be next, you may be next, who knows? So I decided not to do it. That's simple. This is not a matter of trying not to worry. It's not repressing worry, pushing it down into your innards where it will fester into an ulcer. It's feeling around, finding where the worry switch is and pushing it to off. Or rather, it's realizing that you've been repeatedly pushing it to on, and that you can leave off doing that. Resign. It's just a habit. True, Willie is helped by the background mellow of all that weed he smokes, but you're going to have the background mellow of meditation, which is more real and long-lasting, and incidentally makes your brains clearer instead of fuzzier. As you continue to renew and deepen the clarity and relaxation of meditation, it will become more obvious that worry is not something inflicted on you, but something you've chosen to do, and that you therefore can choose to stop. Hitchcock and Willie and Rudolph Abel are not a special breed of people. They're ordinary people who found the switch. This doesn't mean that you become passive or indifferent, or even that feelings of worry never arise. It means that when those feelings do arise, you can apply your new habits. You can breathe through your feet or relax at the moment of contact or use any of several more methods you'll be learning. That creates space around the worried feelings so they don't take over the whole screen of your consciousness, and you can be more effective in problem solving, not less. Where I live, in the Los Angeles area, there are lots of actors scrambling for work. One friend of mine had some meaty featured roles on a couple of popular TV series, and on the strength of that success bought an expensive house in a posh part of town. But then the work started to dry up. He kept getting calls from his agent and going on auditions, but not getting the parts. He started having trouble sleeping, worrying about making his mortgage payments. Finally, he called me one morning, sounding more relaxed than he'd been in months. "I realized what was going on," he said. "I was convinced that if I gave myself permission to stop worrying about the jobs, they would stop coming." That doesn't make sense, does it? As it happened, a few days later, he started getting work again. It was as if once he released his death grip on the thought, "I must get a job," the door swung open and the parts could find him. Do things really work that way? It sounds a bit woo-woo, but I've seen it happen too many times to dismiss it. In particular, I've heard again and again about people who kept searching for the right life partner, till they finally gave up and relaxed, deciding, what the hell, maybe they'd just stay single, and then the right person appeared. Give up. That's a phrase we've been trained to hear as a sad, defeated, loser's ending. But giving is a good thing, and up is a good direction. What if to give up really means to offer the outcome up to God, or the universe, or life, and stop trying to own it all ourselves? In fact, outcomes are never really ours to own or give. All we're doing now is acknowledging, as clear-eyed grown-ups, that in any situation we do what we do, and then what happens, happens. As the Bhagavad Gita says, You have control over your actions only. Over the fruits of your actions, you have no control. People often think Eastern scriptures like the Gita are full of abstract philosophy or mysticism, but this is the most rational, concrete, liberating pragmatism. Mysticism is what we practice when we try to will our team to win the big game or the rain to stop on our day off. Would it help? Nope. I suspect that all that law of attraction stuff is New Age bullshit, and that's good news. It means that, yes, we do what we can as impeccably as we can, and then we're off duty, free. Once Oprah Winfrey was a guest on Stephen Colbert's show, and they talked about their favorite Bible verses. Colbert, who sometimes teaches Sunday school when he's not making television, said his favorite verse was from the Gospels, Jesus' instruction to the disciples. I say to you, do not worry, for who among you by worrying can add a hair to his head or an hour to the span of his life? That's a poetic way of asking, would it help? I recently found myself echoing Jesus' rhetorical question in talking with a woman who frequently attends the Tuesday evening meditation sessions I lead in Santa Monica. She stopped coming for a while, and when she returned, she explained she had been dealing with her father's illness and death. The hardest part, she said, was the conflicted feeling. He was suffering a lot, and I found myself wanting him to let go. But then, how can you wish for your father to die? When I pointed out that her wish didn't matter, that it had no effect, she exhaled and visibly relaxed. And that, I said, is your letting go. This letting go of worry, of futile struggle against what is, works from the smallest annoyance all the way to full-blown crises, when we feel our whole life is melting down. Once my wife and I were on a week-long retreat on beautiful Mount Madonna in Central California, led by Adyashanti. Adya, whose birth name is Steve, is a perfectly ordinary-looking American fellow with a buzz cut, a boyish voice, and a gentle, prankish sense of humor. A student of his once described him as Charlie Brown on acid. I'd say he's the grilled cheese sandwich of awakened sages. At one session, a woman came up to the mic and, choking back her tears, told Adya that she had lost her job and, along with it, her whole sense of her identity. I just had no more roles. I don't have the same interests and ambitions that I used to have in the world. I don't even know who I am in the world anymore. Isn't it delightful? Adya responded. It should be, she said. Then Adya said, well, just try something on for size, okay? You're falling through the sky. You do what everybody does when they fall through the sky, at least for the first time. He mimes clawing desperately at the air. The woman and the audience laugh. It's your body looking for orientation, and it can't find any in space, which makes it panic more, which makes it grasp more. It's like a loop, isn't it? So when we fall, it's like a very visceral, deep sense of instantaneous losing of our whole point of reference. So imagine that you're falling through the sky, and someone comes falling next to you, and they're just sort of... He puts his hands behind his head and leans back, like someone relaxing in a hammock. More laughter. Of course, you would think the person's a little crazy. Why aren't you panicking? Your fear isn't because you're falling. It isn't because you've lost something. Your fear is because you're looking for an orientation that you can't find. You're looking for an identity you can't find. You're looking for things that aren't really there anymore. And it's the looking for them that causes the anxiety and the fear. It's not the falling away. It's the trying to put back together what's fallen away. Again, there's never a reason not to relax. Clawing the air doesn't help. Trying to reassemble the Humpty Dumpty of our lives doesn't help. but it's not needed. Yes, of course, when things change dramatically, it takes adjustment, and that can be hard. But still, your life is never broken. Only your old concept of it is broken. Life is what is always emerging from the